You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for our Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Jasmine. FRKNA coming up on the show. For our weekly catch up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the Manage My Health security breach and Labour's proposed streaming levy. And I spoke to Fleur Fitzsimmons, National Secretary of the Public Service Association, about the election date falling on November 7th, or what is also known as Public Service Day. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about this week's heavy rain and threats of flooding, changes to granny flat building regulations, and marine protections of shellfish. Last week, Te Herenga Anuku published Aotearoa's first report on the state of public land access. I spoke to Doug McCready, the Strategic Relationships Manager at the Outdoor Access Commission, who published the report, and Professor Margaret Mutu about the significance of the publication for Tangata Whenua.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 3093879. Ka au e ware ware I ahi ana koutou te whakonongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakehere ruki ruki mārongi I te pai. Tuku tuku o Erirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Wadu Fitu Iwa 3093879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Manage My Health, a patient information health portal, recently experienced a ransomware attack exposing patients' medical details online. The Privacy Commissioner has announced an inquiry into the breach. Labour has proposed implementing a levy on streaming services, with the revenue being used to support local productions. Irene Gardner, president of the Screen Production and Development Association, says even 5% of the big streamers' revenue would be a game changer. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about both of these issues. I started by asking how concerned he is about cybersecurity in the health sector following the Manage My Health breach.
Well, I'm quite concerned. I've heard from a number of constituents and family members over the holidays that the government's really just been too relaxed around this. This is an absolute breach of our private data, things that people find very, very personal, and they don't want that shared or put at risk. So I'd really like to see Prime Minister Luxon and the government step up in order to demonstrate some leadership and responsibility.
Should private companies like Manage My Health still be trusted with patient data?
I think we should always be cautious when it comes to private agencies. No doubt it's in their contract specifications. But like all organisations that we work with, we have to be incredibly responsible when it comes to the use of people's individual data. And I'm not seeing that leadership from the government, from Minister Simeon Brown as Health Minister. And I think they really need to take some responsibility and acknowledge that there is a significant issue here.
Apart from taking responsibility, what kind of measures should the government be taking to stop this kind of issue from happening again?
Well, I think that the government should be enforcing the security standards that we introduced back in 2022. All health providers must be properly regulated and held accountable in terms of how they handle data, how they protect our data, and we learnt a lot of this over the COVID period too.
And shifting gears, can you talk about the reasoning behind Labour's new streaming levy proposal?
The streaming levy has come out of a members bill. It's something that our caucus had supported to go through that process. Should we be successful in government, then we would really like to explore the opportunities there of what a streaming levy might look like and look to some of the work that's been done in other countries.
And what are the benefits of a streaming levy?
Well, a levy on streamers would ensure big international streaming operators fairly invest directly in local content. We've seen media outlets in Aotearoa New Zealand really struggle. We've seen cuts to media agencies by this government. And so we do have to look to, as the media world changes and changes platforms, we've got to look at new ways of generating revenue to invest here locally.
Are you concerned that a streaming levy could drive up the cost of these services for consumers?
We certainly have to look into that. That's part of the work that would need to be done should we get into government. But it's a good opportunity to explore new ways of generating revenue, how we lift up the media sector, protect jobs, ensure that good content is created, good local New Zealand content that we're all proud of. And so we've got to look at ways that we explore that. But sure, we absolutely have to protect understanding the cost of living challenges that people are facing, that they won't want to be impacted by that.
And in a press release, the ACT Party criticised Labor for wanting to use the levy to fund shows like Celebrity Treasure Island or the recent Jacinda Ardern documentary, implying a conflict of interest. What is your response to this?
Well, that's pretty cheap when the leader, loved being a part of Dancing with the Stars. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. But, you know, if New Zealanders choose to watch particular content, then we should invest in that style of content.
And I just want to finish by asking, are you ready for a November 7th election?
We've been ready over the last 2 years. We've been gearing up for this. Yesterday, getting a set date really is helpful to show there's a sun on the horizon, that we've got something to work towards, and all of our volunteers and movement are ready to go.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on the Manage My Health security breach and Labor's proposed streaming levy.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council. Tāmaki was hit with severe heavy rain warnings in recent days, with extreme weather and states of emergency declared around the motu. This heightened caution around risks of flooding in areas affected by the 2023 Auckland anniversary floods. Last week, there were also changes to national laws that now allow granny flats to be built on properties without the need to obtain resource consent, and stripping of marine life from rock pools around Whangaparoa has raised discussion of shellfish protections, but not without increasing racial tensions and community discourse. I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about how these topics impact Tāmaki Makaurau. Tāmaki has been faced with heavy rain this week along with the rest of the motu. Do you have any messages for those who may be fearing severe impacts, especially following our 2023 flooding?
Yeah, I think it's really important to acknowledge up front a lot of people get really anxious when it rains, and that's totally fair. I have groups in my community who, they don't sleep the nights when there's heavy rain because they've had terrible experiences in 2023, and then in some cases, and it was around this time of the year, of course, that 2023 stuff, and then in some cases also at Easter last year. So it is really stressful for people. The good news is that council's way better prepared than it was in 2023. Our communication with the community about risks and what they can do ahead of time is much better, and so following the Auckland Emergency Management channels, particularly their Facebook, they put a lot of their information up on there, and sharing that information with your neighbours, checking in on people, that kind of stuff. But also just want to acknowledge that my area has been hard hit in the past, that's Albert Eden Puketapapa, but this time around it seems to be our friends in Rodney with some really awful flooding up there, and of course further north in Northland. I'm not sure, because I haven't seen on the news yet, but it's possible that someone has lost their life again in flooding. Don't enter flood water, unless you absolutely have to get to safety. Ask for help. listen to the messages, I guess, about staying home when they are given, and look out for your neighbours. It does look as if it's not going to be as bad from here as it has been the last couple of days, but as we all know, unfortunately, it will keep raining. Well, not unfortunately, it's part of the natural cycle. So, it's just something we have to not so much get used to, but I guess be prepared for, in a way that perhaps in the past we took for granted. So yeah, there's some really good resources online about making your own property safer during flooding, but also, you know, work with your neighbours to advocate to your local board, your local councillors, central government, for the local improvements that we need too. And I know that the group around the Upper Foe catchment in my area, they're holding a meeting tonight for the community to get together and talk about, how do we work together to get the kinds of projects and improvements in that area that we need to not be anxious every time it rains at night. So there's initiatives like that happening all over the place. So have a look out for that in your community.
And what are your thoughts on how changes to granny flat consent rules will impact our city?
Yeah, so the granny flat stuff is quite interesting, and it's one of the things I find interesting about it is that people are referring to them as granny flats rather than tiny homes. So for those who are new to this issue, what's being referred to as a granny flat in this context doesn't have to be for a grandparent. It's a standalone second dwelling that's being built on a site that already has a house. It has to be separate, so it can't sort of be built on the side. It has to be, I think it's 2 metres away from a boundary or another building. So it has to be separate. It has to have its own separate water connections and things like that. And it can be up to 70 square metres, which, to give people a sense of context, is about a quarter of the size of a tennis court. It can only be one storey. I have seen designs where you can fit 2 bedrooms, but you've also got to have, kitchen, bathroom, all of that kind of stuff. And those can now be, as of the 15th of January, built on sites where there's no natural hazard risks, like flooding or landslide, without resource consent. You do need to notify council that you're doing it beforehand, and you need to notify them when it's finished. There are some forms to fill out, there are some fees to pay, and it needs to be done by licensed professionals who will sign off the work. So in theory, if all of that works well, we could see some more opportunities for people who are happy to live in smaller settings like that, where people who maybe own the main house or own the land that it's on could potentially build a second dwelling for aging parents who need to be close by, want to be close by, for adult children who are looking for a chance to live separately from their parents. My eldest just turned 18, so that's in the back of my mind. He's not moving out of home anytime soon, but that could be an option. Those kinds of things. Another form of income that could be rented out. Those kinds of things, right? But there is potentially a risk here, because it's not being resource consented, that there might be some issues around quality that we might find in, 5 or 10 years, that some of these buildings haven't been well built. And so the people living in them, particularly if they're renting, may find themselves in really substandard environments that aren't appropriate. So it's going to be interesting to see how it rolls out. There's an opportunity here to create some more housing, smaller housing, that we need, particularly in places closer to the city where people can access services and transport, jobs, education, all that kind of stuff. But that quality stuff is going to be really important because it's not signed off through the resource consenting process. So I'm optimistic about it. Gives people more flexibility, but I have a little caution there in the back of my mind about that quality aspect as well. So I guess we'll just have to keep an eye on that.
And last week there were reports of rock pools in bays in Whangaparoa being stripped by visitors. What are council's powers over protection of marine life?
So there's quite a lot of stuff that's happened basically since the early 90s around tightening the rules around collection of shellfish. A lot of this is overseen by and enforced by fisheries. So from time to time, people might see if they're at the beaches or around rocky cliff areas and stuff like that, you might see a fisheries officer, and they're there checking that people are not exceeding the limit. So a lot of fish in particular have catch limits, so the fish you catch have to be over a certain size for you to keep them, otherwise you have to put them back in the water so they can get bigger and breed and that kind of stuff. And there might be, you know, like you're only allowed 5 of this species a day or whatever. And so those rules around fish have been in place for a long time and have been tweaked and stuff in response to how those fish populations are going and stuff like that. In the shellfish space, there hasn't been as much regulation, and there are some species that are not really regulated at all, except by a general catch limit, which is 50 a day maximum. And so now that we're seeing more threats to those shellfish populations and this issue potentially of people taking all the fish of a species that they see on a beach, some of it's because we have people living in New Zealand now who are used to eating those species, and they, you know, have eaten those species in countries they've come from, but New Zealanders who've lived here for a long time didn't eat those species. So some of it's about a change in the kinds of food that people eat. Some of it's about just, you know, cost of living, frankly, that this can be a cheap way of sourcing food, and people are desperate for that food. So some of it is an education thing about saying, hey, you know, some of these populations are under threat. We need to take less. And not take the really small ones. Some of it is actually, frankly, about how do we make sure that everybody has enough food to eat, that they're not having to make quite desperate choices. So there's two things happening at the moment around the shellfish, particularly that area around the Whangaparāo Peninsula, where Ngāti Manuhiri, one of the iwi for the area, have requested through fisheries Arahui, so a ban on taking shellfish in those areas for 2 years. Fisheries had submissions open for that that closed in November, and the minister is making a decision on that in the next month. Council has put a submission in on that as well, and also more generally fisheries is putting together some proposals which will be looked at in April that are a bigger picture about some of this shellfish taking that might not be sustainable, and as I say needs an education focus but also an enforcement focus, so that we have this shellfish in the future.
And could you share a comment on the racial tensions arising in community dialogue and conversations about addressing this marine life preservation?
Yeah, I think it's really sad that some people sort of go straight there. I have seen some comments about it being migrants. Some people have picked out specific types of migrants. I don't know that that's particularly helpful, because I think there's probably plenty of people who aren't migrants who don't know the rules. But I think also we do need to acknowledge that there are people who live in New Zealand who have come from cultures where they eat the little shellfish. And that's more of an education piece. I don't think anybody's out there wanting to destroy species. I think people are just perhaps not aware. And so I think there is some value in making sure that the communication that goes out about this stuff happens in a multitude of languages, that it involves community leaders from a multitude of communities. But I don't think it's very helpful to blame people. I mean, I remember in the 90s, when there was a lot of stuff around Asian drivers, and actually if you looked at the stats, it really wasn't borne out. It's just that people were more visible, and I suspect there might be something similar going on here too, is that, you know, yeah. So I guess I would just encourage people to see this as a chance to communicate across cultures as opposed to blaming. And assume the best. Assume that people are have good intentions and don't necessarily know that what they're doing is potentially breaking a rule or potentially harmful, even if it's not technically breaking a rule. And, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. That's what I would appreciate if I was in if I moved to a different country and was doing something that other people didn't like.
That was Councillor Julia Ferry on this week's Heavy Rain and Threats of Flooding, Changes to Granny Flat Building Regulations and Marine Protections of Shellfish.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day? No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395. This is some Faye Webster.
I didn't know I was capable being happy right now, but you showed me how. I didn't know that you were right in front of me until I looked up.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's the beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Decalcify your pineal gland, live on broadcast radio. It's a contact lens for your third eye, a pacemaker for your anahata chakra.
Rehabilitate your aura with Aaron on psychic glands. Delicate, psychedelic, transcendent, blissful.
Psychic Glands, every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on 95BFM and available eternally on podcast and RSS at 95BFM.com.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The Outdoor Access Commission, Heringa Anuku, published Aotearoa's first report on the state of national public land access last week. The report revealed how up to a third of Māori land is considered landlocked, citing this as one of the biggest challenges to public access in 2025. I first spoke to Strategic Relationships Manager of Heringa Anuku, Doug McCready, about the research journey and the address of increasing accessibility to landlocked areas for landowners. Kia ora, Doug. What was this research journey like for the organisation? Could you talk us through the process?
Yeah, so the Outdoor Access Commission, Heringa Anuku, has been around for a fair amount of time, since the 90s, and we have a number of field people that deal with public access opportunities and challenges. And so within the organisation, we also have a GIS team, specialist advisors. And so within the organisation, there's just a wealth of knowledge and history relative to the kaupapa. We're a very small organisation, so we felt that one thing that we could do was basically summarise and capture the knowledge we have in a form that was palatable for the public in terms of giving a general picture of what public access looks like in New Zealand. So it was largely an internal process, but with our individual experts and all drawing on years and years of experience and external context.
How do the results about Māori landlocked whenua compare to your organisation's expectations when you were pulling all of this knowledge together?
Yeah, so really, really interesting space. So firstly, the definition of landlocked, it can be looked at in many different ways. So we have a block of land that's located way out, you know, in the hills and the forest, and there is no road, no actual physical road. There, we would call that, you know, access is limited. But it's kind of degrees of landlocked. So it may be landlocked from a driving and an easy access point of view, but for an experienced tramper navigator, it may technically not be landlocked. So just from the outset, I just want to clarify that when we talk about landlocked, we're actually talking about a different range of ways of interpreting that word. And then you bring into the equation paper roads, which are unformed legal roads is the correct term, and they provide legal access, but sometimes or often they're not practical to traverse because of the quality, the steepness, and many other reasons that a unformed legal road may not actually be usable. So our findings, I believe, were as expected. We well know, and it is publicly available information around ahu whenua land blocks that are managed under that come under the jurisdiction of the Ture Whenua Act under the Māori Land Court, and anyone can just look at a map and see that many of these blocks are located in remote places with no or limited access. So I'd say that the findings generally were as expected. The interesting element is that, you know, we have seen at times a perception that Māori land blocks access to public land, but I think it would be fair to say that from a logical analysis based on mapping and observation, it's actually typically the other way around.
And what prevents land ownership and different pathways to accessibility to this land from being addressed in closer synchronicity with one another?
So there are approximately 8,000 ahu whenua land blocks in Aotearoa, New Zealand. There is also what we refer to as te tiriti settlement land. So that's land that's returned to tangata whenua via the treaty settlement process. And then we also acknowledge and understand what we refer to as mana whenua whānui, where there is hapu mana whenua over all land, which doesn't align with a legal ownership concept, but it's really tying back into how the hapu are dispersed and relate to one another across, you know, fluid boundaries, stories, history, etc. So a more holistic way of looking at land occupation. So whenever we think about land, we think tangata whenua Māori land, we actually think about it from three or maybe even four different perspectives to start with. It's important that obviously the legal delineations are primary lens, but also the holistic lenses and the way that things have eventuated in reality is also very important, because often you can make better gains in terms of progressing and moving forward for everybody if you are working from a perspective that meaningfully takes into account the actual reality of any particular land or blocks of land and how they're used. So we know that in relation to landlocked tangata whenua land, a lot of that or most of that came about during the era of land confiscations, land sales, and the early dealings of the New Zealand Company and the Crown acquiring land. And often, or almost always, Māori were left with the difficult to access remnants, whereby the primary objective in those times, as I understand it, was to acquire land that was suitable for farming. And so the consequences is that we have these many, many blocks that are steep, they're rugged, they're often covered in bush, and they're very difficult to access physically. Then we also have another feature of New Zealand history, which is unformed legal roads, whereby many, many roads were drawn on paper for various reasons, but were never actually built. And so you put the two together and you find that for a percentage of the time, accessing the landlocked Māori blocks can be improved or through the understanding where the unformed legal roads are, and learning, experimenting, and basically finding out whether or not you can traverse them and developing that. The second method is to work with neighbours of those blocks and build relationships and access the lands via the neighbouring blocks, and that can lend itself towards establishing access easements through other properties by agreement. So there are ways to progress the situation, but of course to even begin we need to know where those blocks are, we need to know who the neighbours are, we need to have a level of resourcing to be able to travel there, and a level of knowledge to be able to utilise the services of agencies and the various GIS tools, etc., to begin that journey. And so if we extrapolate that thinking a bit further, there's a massive opportunity to liberate those land blocks and to have them potentially used productively. And when I say productively, obviously in a sense of ecotourism or other uses of, you know, conservation and sustainable use of the native forest resource that most of them have on them. There's opportunities to work with DOC in terms of predator and pest control. And in many, many cases, the landlocked Māori blocks are already being used by the public because there's a lack of an established governance group and any form of presence of the tangata whenua owners, they often just default to being used by those resourced explorers who are able to get out there, or in some cases, neighbouring farms will, you know, graze them or have some sort of overlap in terms of their farming practice that spills over into the Māori block. So there's a really, while it's not an ideal situation at the moment, there is a huge amount of potential to move it forward and to develop. And the public access element is very tightly aligned both in that development process and in terms of the future potentials of what the blocks could potentially be used for. There are also examples of ahu whenua blocks in this very situation who have already gone down this path and created hunting cabins and tracks and trails, established governance structures and you know, pest control and all those types of things. And so it's working hand in hand with the objectives of the you know, wider conservation estates that often border them, as well as reaching and achieving the aspirations of the tangata whenua group.
I then spoke to Professor Margaret Mutu, who spoke on the report from the wider historical colonial context of the ability of tangata whenua to access their land. Margaret particularly highlighted the discrepancies between Pākehā landowners and Māori in their legal and physical abilities to access and utilise land under their ownership with ease. Kia ora, Margaret. How do you feel about this report on the state of land access in Aotearoa?
Access to land throughout the country has always been a big thing for Pākehā ever since they arrived here back in the early 1800s. And it's one of the key bugbears of the treaty claim settlement process, that if you want land back from the government and you're not prepared to pay full market price for it, you have to provide full public access to the land. And that's something that's bugged Māori for a long time, is that we are required by law to provide public access to our own lands that were stolen off us, that are returned under the treaty settlements process. But what this report highlights is a problem that has bedeviled Māori ever since the Māori Land Court was set up, and that is that Māori land, there are thousands and thousands of hectares of Māori land that are landlocked, and that there is no legal, Pākehā legal access to this Māori land. The area where this is most, that I've certainly heard the most about, is around the Taihape area, where there is more than 50,000 hectares of Māori land there that the owners have not been able to legally get access to for nearly a century. So this is an old problem for Māori, and I don't know whether I'm pleased or whether that a government department has finally made it public that for many Māori, even accessing the tiny 4% of the land in this country that we still have, we can't even get access to it. I don't know whether I'm pleased to see that in a government report or just looking at them and going, whatever, we've been fighting this for over a century, and now you're finally going to tell the public that this is what you've done to us. I have to say that when that report came out of the Waitangi Tribunal in 2024, I know what we would do up home if we were told we couldn't legally access our land. We'd say, to hell with you lot. This is our land, and you're not going to tell us whether we can or cannot access our own land. And we would just go there. And I did ask the people, the iwi and hapu from Taihape, why do you even listen? The whole Māori Land Court, parliamentary government justice system in this country is illegitimate. We know that. Why do you even listen to them? And their answer was quite simple, was that was exactly the approach that their kaumātua took, that they were not going to be dictated to by effectively colonising invaders. And they were going to access their land still. Well, they got arrested and thrown into jail. So that's the reality, is that this report has maybe brought to the public's attention that there is a very large amount of Māori land that we are not legally allowed to access, and it creates a huge problem for those Māori landowners.
How do you see this report published last week by He Reanga Ānuku influencing political movements around whenua?
Well, I would hope that it would give Māori landowners, whānau, hapū, who are directly affected by this, the strength and the confidence to say, this is not right, it's never been right, and we're not going to be restricted by these crazy laws that you put in place that tell us that we are supposed to negotiate with the new owner of the land, pay that new owner to get access, and pay for all the government process that we have to go to get that recognised. And I would hope that our people would say, to hell with that. You stole the land illegally. You should never have done it. And then to tell us we can't have the rest of our land. We know what happens with quite a few of this land. If it's at all usable, the Pākehā person who purchased the adjoining land then gets to use our land that we're not allowed to access for free. And then for him to then say, oh, well, I now claim this land as mine. That has happened throughout the country. And I would hope that our people would have the confidence now to say, this is not on, never ever was on, and we're not going to tolerate it anymore. We will get access to our land, and let the government sort out the problem that it created in the first place by stopping us from our land. Let it sort out its Pākehā landowners.
So what is most important from here following this new release of information, which, you know, is something that's already known and has been evidenced in last week's report?
So the most important thing is that you've brought to the public's attention that there is a massive injustice here that discriminates against Māori landowners and says that while public access to Pākehā landowners is always guaranteed, that is not the case for Māori. That is totally unjust. It is illegal in terms of the way other non-Māori landowners are treated, and that this is something that must be addressed by the Pākehā Parliament, because Māori are going to address it under our own laws, our own tikanga, and if you're not ready for that, then you have got to get ready now and accept the fact that you cannot keep doing this to Māori and get away with it.
That was Doug McCready, the Strategic Relationships Manager from He Reanga Ānuku, the Outdoor Access Commission, followed by Professor Margaret Mutu, both commenting on the background and significance of Aotearoa's first report on the state of public land access published by He Reanga Ānuku last week that revealed up to a third of Māori land is considered landlocked.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is Don't Delete the Kisses from Wolf Ellis.
Thank you.
doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has announced that the election will be held on November 7th. November 7th is also what is known as Public Service Day, marking the anniversary of when the first Public Service Act became law in Aotearoa 114 years ago. I spoke to Public Service Association National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimmons about the significance of this year's election date. I started by asking what November 7th means for the public service.
So November 7th in New Zealand is Public Service Day, and that is the day that the very first Public Service Act was passed in this country. And that was the day that a politically neutral and professional public service was established in the interests of all New Zealanders. So it's been known as Public Service Day for that reason. And what we're saying is that it's particularly ironic that this government has chosen Public Service Day for the general election, given their dismal record when it comes to the public service. They've overseen cuts to public services and the dismissals of thousands of public servants who were really committed to their work and had more to give to New Zealand. And it was all done for the purpose of funding this government's tax cuts for landlords. So we're really optimistic that this choice of day will mean that the election does focus on public services and this government's dismal record. It's a referendum on this government.
Will the significance shape the PSA's election campaigning?
Certainly going to shape our approach to the election campaign. Public Service Day is an important day on our calendar every year, but this year it has real significance, given that the general election of a government that, in the test of a government that has made the most damaging cuts to the public service, is really being determined on this day. So it will change the focus of our election campaign in that we will be reminding people of what this government has done to the public service, the impact of those cuts that are being felt now, but will also be felt for generations to come.
Are there any particular parts of the public service you'll encourage people pay special attention to during the campaign? I'm thinking about health, for example.
We will be drawing attention to this government's agenda in health. What we have seen from the government is thousands of public health workers dismissed. We have seen no commitment to funding our hospital system in the way that New Zealanders deserve and expect. And all of that is coming through every single day with the horror stories from our hospitals. You can see data and digital systems are really struggling under the pressure of having lost expertise and operating on legacy systems. We're seeing outages that last for whole days in one instance in the Canterbury region recently. That meant that clinicians couldn't access digital charts which go and outline things like medication doses, a patient's history, clinical notes. We're seeing it in long waiting lists, hospitals constantly in code red. These are the direct result of this government's failure to properly fund our health system, and we're going to use the election to hold them to account for it.
And is there anything else you'd like to say about the upcoming election date?
This government has been the most anti-worker government in New Zealand history. They've attacked pay equity. They're about to introduce a law which will mean that every worker is subject to insecure employment. They're instituting an approach of fire at will that will radically change every workplace. Every single day between now and the election, we will be making sure that New Zealanders understand just how destructive this government has been for working people and the false promise they made to put the cost of living front and centre of their approach to governing this country. We have seen wages not keep pace with prices under Christopher Luxon's leadership, and we'll be holding him to account for that.
That was Fleur Fitzsimmons, National Secretary of the Public Service Association, on the election date falling on November 7th, or what is also known as Public Service Day.
Well, if you want to save money in health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, He Ranga Anuku's Doug McCready, the University of Auckland's Margaret Mutu, and the Public Service Association's Fleur Fitzsimmons. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.